This free program is paid for by the listeners of WBAI New York. If you're not already a member, think about joining us to help keep free speech alive.
222-7122. Learn more about alcohol and your health at Alcohol Awareness Day.
And you are tuned to listener-supported, commercial-free, community radio WBAI in New York at 99.5 FM. It's 1 p.m. Stay tuned for The Positive Mind with Armand DeMille.
Hi, everybody. This is Armand DeMille with The Positive Mind. WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial. Bringing you ideas, concepts, and guests to help you lead a more positively minded life. And we've been focusing this week on your relationship to mechanical devices. Finding out that there's a lot more relationship to machines nowadays than we would have ever imagined many years ago. Today we're going to focus on the computer. Yep, the computer. We have with us in the studio my two very, very favorite. Well, two out of my three very favorite. Five now. Now I've got five computer people. I love them all. Tom Gerby, who helps get us up on the website. He's not here today. And Booker Irvin. God knows who got the whole thing started. He's not with us. But with us today, John Greenleaf from Mac Mechanics, which is a computer service organization that I've known John for many, many years. And Raj Goyal, who is a pioneer. He started BrainLink International. And BrainLink is my service provider. We've had to do some real fishing to find out what people function with integrity, and we found BrainLink to be the place to do it. So when you hear me tell you, send me an email, armand@brainlink.com. This is Raj Goyal, and the fifth person who's not here is Sharon Goyal, because she's his mate. And the other starter, is that right? Welcome to the program, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. Sharon can't be here. Okay, well, Sharon, you're probably listening. You think she's listening?
Yes.
Sharon, we wish you were here, because I'm dying to see your face. Because like so many people, you're going to have relationships with computer people and never know what they look like. What is a computer, right? Now, let's look at just what the word means. A computer, one that computes. The word com means with. Where do you think the word pewter comes from? You think it's from the metal? No, it comes from the Latin root putare, P-U-T-A-R-E, which means to section in pieces. And to, it's another word for to think. So actually, computer means with pieces put together. Everybody has what's called a love-hate relationship with their computers, or many people do. A love-hate relationship is a personal relationship between humans, or figuratively between humans and an inanimate object like a computer. Here's the way it works. You love it, and you hate it. Or many of you just love it, but when it treats you bad, you hate it. And this thing begins to happen. Many people perceive computers as a living thing, a thing that is not only that understands you, but they don't see it as a machine. Let me see if I get this right. I think a computer is a glorified calculator. Would I be insulting computers if I said that? And could computers feel insult?
Well, no, computers can't feel insult. But that it is basically a very complicated
calculator.
That's all it is.
It calculates and puts things together. You think, Raj, you think the computer god is going to come after me and say,
I don't think computers would feel insulted, but the computer god might. He's a vengeful god, or she's a vengeful god. She might crash you after the show.
Crash me after the show. Computer relationships. Here's where you know you have a relationship with your computer. You wake up at 4 o'clock in the morning, and you go to the bathroom, and you stop by to check your email on your way to the bathroom, right? You laugh at people who have 56K modems, right? You think there's something wrong with them. Those are called slow-mos. You start using smileys. You know what that smiley is? That colon with the little parenthesis thing in your regular mail, in your snail mail. You can't correspond with your mother because she doesn't own a computer. You know you really have a strong relationship with your computer when your email box shows no new messages and you get depressed. But that's virtually impossible today with spam. And we're going to tell you the origin of the word spam if you stick with us today. The other thing about having a computer, and you know you have a relationship with your computer, when your family always knows where you are. They can find you anytime, day and night. Where is he? Where is he? He's at the computer. This is Armand DeMille with you. It sounds like fun. A recent survey revealed that 2 out of 3 office workers spend at least 6 hours a day using a computer. 2 out of 3 people in an office spend 6 hours a day at a computer. Now, I have a pretty big office here. The people who work here do not spend 6 hours a day in front of a computer, maybe 1 hour a day in front of the computer. The rest of it is all personal contact. I had no idea. So as I did my investigation into people in offices, almost every one of you out there who are listening who work in an office can spend as many as 8 hours of your day, of your working day, in front of your computer. Is that true?
Yes.
No, absolutely.
People go in. People go into their offices, turn on their computer, and then everything from graphics to...
The way in which this world is now constructed requires that the work done in the office is going to be done on computer. It can be shared. It can be duplicated. It can be as well as much quicker to accomplish the tasks, but that is where business is going.
Business and personal, and working in an office means sitting down in front of it.
And it just that means not only sitting in front of a computer, but with more and more of the younger professionals, you have Trios, you've got Blackberries, you've got cell phones. I know professionals who spend 12, 18 hours a day in front of a computer, around a computer.
I'm surprised the computer's not in the bed yet. You know what I mean? I'm surprised that the bed doesn't function that way, you know? Like you get in and it weighs you today and it tells you your weight. You gained 5 pounds today. Now roll over to your left. Roll over to your right. You know, like the computer eventually is going to be sensing you completely, probably performing all of your nightly duties.
It's coming.
It's coming soon.
Well, absolutely. Part of our job in setting up computers is to make sure that a wireless network's available so that they can do their computing in bed.
People do now.
And that's the next step. I would say where we're actually going will be a centralized computer in the house that will then be available in every room by voice contact.
What do you mean by that, John?
There'll be a centralized computer that'll control your appliances and your TV connection and your internet connection. You'll have a screen in every room, and you'll speak to the computer rather than input via keyboard.
So you'll actually tell the computer, start the toast.
Exactly.
That's not so far away. We thought about robots doing this. But every machine becomes a robot with access through a computer. We're talking about John Greenleaf and Raj Goyal from Raj Goyal's with BrainLink International that provides ISP services and is one of the leading companies providing internet safety features for people and educating people on how they could protect themselves from the invasions that seem to be coming along with this stuff. We're going to be talking about that also. My computer, you know, my computer. I personalize my computer. My computer is my fonts, my keyboard, my way I look at it, my carrying it around the house. Is it true people sleep with their computers now? So I guess if you have a laptop, you just It's what it means, laptop.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Well, they may not sleep with it in bed, but it's often next to them. They'll close it and put it away and be able to open it the first thing when they open their eyes in the morning.
Do you think that this has happened very fast? When I was thinking about it, and I thought, Raj and I said, well, how long have I known you? And I said to John, how long have I known you? And we realized our relationship is only about 10 years. And I feel like I've known you forever. I feel like I've been involved with this forever. The speed and the intensity of the development of computers has led many of us to be actively involved in a very big way. John, you were talking about the different kind of computer savvy or computer users. Let's run that down. You came up with five different types, right?
I thought of this as I came in today, and I tried to generalize and sort of quantify who my clients are. And they really begin at, I have very few clients like this, but there are a couple for whom the computer is just a box. They really can't understand or use it, click on it, understand why it does what it does or what it can do for them. And they're very few, but these people, they have no need for a computer, ultimately. Even though I think it would make a better life for them, the pressure that they're under in order to accomplish it is not worth the advantages that they'll get.
I want to go back a second. You know, there's a number of people I know who do not have, they don't have a microwave, they don't have a cell phone, they don't have a beeper, and they believe that if you put any look at that face. Raj, you don't believe there's anybody without a microwave?
I find it impossible to believe that.
Impossible. How old are you?
35.
I fully understand why you think it's impossible. But there are many people who believe that the microwaves are dangerous. Okay? That they say, no, the microwave emissions are dangerous. There are many people who think that you could get brain cancer from cell phones. And I'm not, you know, I mean, this is what they believe, even though I've seen the research to the contrary. There are people who believe that the less electronic devices you have in your life, the more your brain is free of those things. Like, you know, having a TV in your bedroom, you know, maybe you're better off without any electric in your bedroom. Maybe you sleep different. So there are people who believe that, but the people who believe that to the point where they don't want to have a computer, John, is kind of what you're talking about. There are people who want the simple life. Now, I'm going to go to that in a second, except I want to say that the Amish have many computers now known for their simplest style of life, but they have computers, and there's practically no farmer who dares try to run a farm without having a major access to his computer for prices and everything else that goes through it.
Absolutely, for orders. It is part of the way in which this world works. But we have to remember that their relationship to the computer would be the same as a relationship to a hammer or to a harness. It is a tool that they use in order to accomplish what they want. It doesn't become the overpowering center of their lives.
But I think that depends on your profession. And if you're a farmer, it's a tool. If you're a stockbroker, it's your lifeblood. And if you know, we're moving from a manufacturing economy and a farm economy to an information economy. And for information workers, the computer is not just a tool, it's our livelihood. And for more and more of the younger professionals, you know, the 20-something and up crowd, who've never known a life without a computer, it's not a tool, it's a utility. It's like electricity, it's like telephone, it's like the air they breathe. And I dare say, you know, we did a study recently, hospital had a problem, the networks melted, huge problem, and their staff over 35 had no problems running the hospital, delivering care, treating patients. Staff under 35 was completely helpless. They didn't know how to fill the paper forms out. Some of these doctors and nurses had never seen a paper admissions chart. And that's true in most businesses. Go to McDonald's, try to order something when the computers are down. You can't get fries without a computer working.
And that fits right in and almost exactly with the breakdown in terms of age, because age is the defining feature of our relationship with computers. I discussed my son with Armand earlier today, and he's 14 years old, has never been without a computer. Even from the time he was 2 years old, he had his own place to work and play. And as far as he's concerned, life without a computer would be impossible.
You know, one of the things we discovered yesterday, the research I did with Roberta Atti, we did a program on your relationship to television. Television is doomed, according to our research, that TV as we know it, somebody entertaining you and you having a passive relationship with the TV, is gone for the kids. The kids don't want that anymore. They want interactive. They want to have some kind of effect on the TV. And so television, which we couldn't imagine disappearing, is kind of soon going to go the way of an interactive computerized exchange.
Well, in a television, if you look at history of entertainment, television is an aberration. Throughout human history, entertainment has been interactive. But the storytellers, the singers, the artists, you know, the medieval fair jugglers, you always had an interaction with the entertainers. Television, and to some extent radio, are aberrations. That's the first mass medium we've had where there's no interaction. And now with the new interactive software and games going on, that relationship is changing. You know, we're going back in one way, in some way back to our human roots, but with better tools, better technology, better, faster, cheaper.
It's back to stick and stones. Well, except they're going to be ones and zeros. Matrix algebra. You know, Matrix algebra? Did you ever hear of such a thing?
Yes.
Matrix algebra related to computers?
Yes.
It is. Well, when I was a kid, I took this course called Matrix Algebra in high school. They forced us. Now, this is at a time, and I said, it was introduction to matrix algebra. It made no sense at all these ones and zeros. And I said, what's the application? But computers were not invented yet. They were invented, but they weren't anywhere near us. So they thought they would be giving us this advance. I took introduction to matrix algebra. I studied it. It was brutal. I was great at math, but there was no application, you see. And then they said, it's the introduction to the course where you'll see the application. And the following semester, they canceled it. They canceled the course, and there was never to be seen again. And there I was, stuck with this concept in my mind that had no use. Now you're saying it's a basis. This is it. So here we are, my friends. Listen, so if they're running around, if the Amish now have computers and the farmers have computers, there are people, as we're talking about, there are some people who don't want that invasion. You live up in the mountains somewhere and you don't want to have electronics in your life other than your radio to listen to the Positive Mind. Your computer, which is now used, mind you, to access current and past programs of the Positive Mind all over the world, anytime, day and night, 7 days a week. That's amazing. People are listening to us somewhere in Saudi Arabia, you know, and they're kind of getting together around a tent, you know, and that's what they do, right? Intents. Right. So you sit in tents and you turn on the computer and they say, listen to this guy talk about women walking around that freely, saying what they need. So this is getting all around, and it's all through the graces of this machine. So we have types of people, children, John, who grow up always with a computer from the day they were born. They get little sing-song computers, right?
Absolutely, and also as learning. I mean, Jack learned math. Jack learned history on his computer. That was his interaction. They are the antithesis of the person for whom the computer means nothing. My Jack literally could not survive without his computer.
He wouldn't know what to do.
He would have no concept of how to spend his day if he wasn't at least. And he's not. We're not talking about someone who sits in front of it. We're talking about someone for whom he can see it from across the room, and it's doing things that he wants it to do, and he may check in on it. He may have five or six processes going at one time, and it will be there to allow him the freedom to go someplace else and do something, knowing it's doing what he wants at that time. It's hard to imagine.
Well, you know, and I think about France, India, and Mexico starting to put in cell phone jammers so that cell phones are not so available. Right. If you imagine cell phones down and then maybe email down as well, because for some reason or another it's crowding things, people would have to do a thing like write a letter and you put a stamp on it and you mail it. I wonder if does your son ever get a letter?
Yes, he does.
What does he think of it when you hand it to him? I mean, it must be precious.
Exactly. They're handwritten letters.
handwritten letters.
Rather than even typed or printed letters from a computer, they're actually handwritten. And they're saved.
We have to send some mail around, don't you think?
Yeah.
I've got to get back to notepaper. Remember your own personal stationery? Okay, so two types of people,
right.
The very young. The older who say, I may be dying any day now. I got 20 years to go. I'm going to try to get by without this device in my mind.
Exactly. And then in between them are, as Raj was saying, the combination, the over 35er that has lived with a computer long enough but still can remember how to function without one.
Mm-hmm.
The computer for them, I think, is a real tool. They don't have that deeper relationship with it, although it depends. Sometimes those people can have a power book in their hands that is their best friend, and if it has to go in for repair, it's a tragedy.
So now we're talking about my field, which is in your relationship to your computer, sometimes it becomes your entire source.
Mm-hmm.
It becomes the thing that is best to you. Well, if you think about it, it's kind of amazing. You could turn it on and turn it off at will, right? You can't do that with your mate,
mm-hmm.
right? You want your mate to turn on. You know, you've got to buy flowers. You have to do something. You can tell it what you want it to do, and it will generally do it for you. This is an unusual relationship. You try to take that relationship that you have with these 4 or 5 hours you'll spend with a computer, and even though I don't want to joke about this, but the majority of computerized email communications are finding and searching out sex sites. So there's a whole new relationship with a computer and your sexuality, and it kind of goes out there. Many people, I mean, the majority of people are searching out sex visuals, information, stories, people like them. So this is out there now, and so that's another personal relationship, because here you have all of your sexual excitement through this device, and this device becomes precious to you. So for people 35 and older, you would find around that age, and we're going to do that with the origin of the computer being really the personal computer about 1983, 84, somewhere in there, the real growth of it, which is we're talking about 22, 23 years old at this point, computers. The 35-year-old may have picked up the computer somewhere in their adult life. Imagine you're a photo retoucher. This I ran into recently. A guy's a photo retoucher. And one guy I met, and I met the same guy in 2 days, he says, no, I do it the old way. I do it by hand. And I said, in my mind, I said, this is a dying breed.
You're crazy.
Right? Well, no, I didn't consider him crazy. He's valued.
Well, he is, but...
He's valued. He's valued in his own way, John. He's got his own thing going for him. But I met the next man who does it all by Photoshop. You see, and he's got this other thing, and I found these two ways just crossing over. You know, the one man who still does it the old way and the guy who does it the new way. You know, still crossing over. Types of people. Now there's a type of person, John, who gets a computer and must have all the function that a computer has. Who is that?
Right. Those, ironically, those are the folks, a lot of CEOs, a lot of people that are used to giving orders or believe themselves to be in that position, they will get a computer and require the computer to do everything that the computer can do simply because it can do it. They want it to be automatic. They don't. It's a slave to them, is basically what it is. It should do what I want to do automatically. I'm going to drive it like a sports car, and I don't want to know... I don't want to have to configure it. I don't want to have to interact with it. I just want it to do what I mean rather than what I say. It's a totally different way of looking at the computer. It's not a soft way at all. It's nothing touchy-feely about it. It is basically a computer to be used as a slave to accomplish what they want.
I want this instrument to work for me.
If it's the sense of buying a Swiss Army knife, and then they want to use every single blade in that Swiss Army knife, and they'll buy a computer that that I want to be able to do video, I want to do voiceover internet, I want to have it get my mail, sort my mail, tell me what's important, rather than actually make the effort to think about the information they're getting.
Yeah, I don't even think that slave is the appropriate word, because slaves you have to maintain in some kind of way. So
exactly.
I think you're talking about having the finest instrument, having the finest tool you could find, and you want it to be functional. And then if something goes wrong with it, unlike a mate, you know, if your wife gets a cold, you got to take care of her. If your husband gets sick, you got to kind of see what's going on. If your baby has some kind of a problem, you rush it off to the doctor. These are things you don't feel anything about. You call John, who we're sitting with, John Greenleaf, and you say, John, fix my computer. And that's it. And that's their attitude with you, right? John,
absolutely.
Go up. And you go visit people's homes. I know you have keys to my home, or practically have keys to my home. And you just go up and you take care of it. And
right. They
don't care of, show me what went wrong, show me how it went wrong, let me learn more about it for the future.
Yeah, exactly. And because of our relationship, I feel I can do that. Mm-hmm. I can go up there and work on your computer without you being there. For many users, it's essential that I'm with them and interact with them and find out exactly how they're using that computer before I fix it. Some things aren't worth fixing if they're not going to use it.
All right, so that's three types we have.
Right.
What else do you have?
Well, the best friend, the person for whom that we've already touched on it, but it's the person for whom the computer is the center of their life. It's their contacts, it's their entertainment, and it's their work, all combined. And actually, the last is the ultimate tool, just to accomplish specific work. And a lot of people have that relationship to their work computer. They don't have anything on it except work. They don't have their pictures, they don't have their music, they don't have their thoughts, so to speak. And it really is an impersonal object to them that merely provides the work.
Probably the biggest thing that happens to people, and the very strange thing that's happened to people on a personal level, is the phenomenon of the Internet.
Mm.
The Internet is like, that's the piece that it's almost impossible to live without now.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And it is in this way that we're going to have to look at the way that people have. Number one, meeting people in line has become the primary way of meeting people now.
Yes.
And at first we used to think of this as a terrible thing. How could you meet people online as opposed to why not go to a bar, have a few drinks, and meet a person that way? Well, Craigslist and meeting online seems to be the primary new way of doing it. People finding jobs and homes from the Internet. People buying products on the Internet now and paying their bills and managing their homes. It's just there. And this brings us to the world of the Internet. And now what's happened is there seems to be a new level that everybody is stepping up to. Here you have the pleasure of all this stuff. You have the pleasure of being able to pay all of your bills and talk to whoever you want. And if you're somebody who is interested in all that sexual curiosity, you could have as much sexual curiosity as you want. And one would imagine, what's the downside to this? Where is the downside? I mean, isn't it nice to buy things on eBay? You know, musical instruments, by the way, have dropped radically in price because they're now available on the auction line. You used to be able to buy a cello. You know, a cello would cost you $1,000, $1,500 to get something decent. The prices have dropped radically because cellos are coming out of the closets and they're being brought up for sale. So there's all of the advantage of this. And now comes the thing that always happens, the downside. The downside of a number of things involving identity theft and so on and so forth. And for that reason, I asked Raj Goyal to join us. We're going to take a short break, my friends, and when we come back, we're going to talk about the Internet and people's relationship with the Internet, and specifically talk about issues like identity theft, what's possible and not possible, logical and not logical, what you could expect. We'll be back with you in just a couple of moments. This is Armand DeMille. Back with you soon.
You're tuned to Hi-Fi. WBAI 99.5 on your FM dial, New York.
Tahrir, liberation. Marhaba, I'm Barbara Nimri Aziz. Tahrir is a long WBAI tradition and still strong in voices of the Arab Muslim community here and abroad. I invite you to tune in Tuesday evenings at 7 for discussions on Islam and society, justice and injustice, in-depth interviews with writers from across the world, and Fen Mashnoon, Crazy Arts, with Dean and Maysoon.
Jada, once again, this is Cal Jada with Star Eyes, S-T-A-R-I-S. This is Armand DeMille, The Positive Mind, WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial in New York City. We're talking with Raj Goel, G-O-E-L, who is the Chief Technology Officer and founder or co-founder of BrainLink International, my favorite internet place. And we're speaking with John Greenleaf from Mac Mechanics. And we're talking about computers, the phenomenon of the computer. And now we want to get to dealing with the internet. And here's really why I wanted to have Raj by, because the next level of dealing with the internet is dealing with your own, what happens to you? What happens when somebody sends you unwarranted emails? Spam, the word spam. I like this story. Spam, what does the word mean? All right, this is not a true story, but I'm going to say we found on the internet. Single post to all message bases, S-P-A-M. Not you, Raj. You're too much of a realist for that, right?
Agreed.
Where does it come from?
It's an old technical joke referring to Monty Python and the Holy Grail, where they did spam, 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 and when the first emails came out. And the computer industry is full of obscure references, puns, and plays on words. So spam just came out of a reference to Monty Python. And then when Hormel started cracking down on people using their trademark for a nuisance email, a couple of guys reverse engineered this acronym.
Reverse engineered an acronym. I like that. In other words, they took this acronym and they said, all right, well, the real issue is this.
It's got to stand for something. We'll make something up.
Well, what happens? You know, somebody once said to me, the person who gets the most spam is the person who has spent most of their time on sex sites. Meaning that whenever you go to a sex site to investigate, that email, your email address gets sent out to a whole bunch of places, and they in turn will send you all kinds of stuff. It's no coincidence that if you're investigating sex sites, you're going to get a lot of Viagra kind of commercials.
That used to be the case a couple of years ago, but these days that's no longer true. You have to have is email address. With the growing rise of automated spyware and spam tools and the army of bots in machines that have been compromised through spyware and viruses to send spam out, these days if you put up a new machine on the Internet, within 17 minutes it's going to get broken into if you don't have the proper security on it.
Well, there are some people, mm-hmm. Raj, who get no spam. And they use their internet, and they use it to buy things online, and they get things. Now, here's the downside, and here's the tough side. You have the safety of the privacy of going to your computer and checking out anything you want, paying your bills, and then all of a sudden, you've been invaded. Now, even worse than getting spam is this next level of it, which is identity theft. Could you describe what identity theft is?
Sure. Let me give you a quick story to share with you that will bring this ID theft into better perspective. This is a story MSNBC ran a couple of months ago about a woman who got in the middle of everything else she was going through. She had death in the family. She was dealing with the estate and so on. She got an email claiming to be from her bank. And it said, you know, there's a problem with your account. Please log in and change your password. She ignored it. And over the next couple of days, she got more and more insistent spam email messages, which claimed to be coming from her bank. So she said, you know, to get them off her bank, she clicked on the email, typed in her ID and her password, and within a matter of days, she lost $3,000. People in Ukraine, in Russia, in Eastern Europe had now gotten hold of her account and her password, because what the email she thought was coming from her bank actually came from criminal gangs who had mocked up an email that looked like it came from her bank, but it was actually what's called a phishing attack.
A phishing attack? You mean the one I get from eBay, which just amazes me. Mm-hmm. eBay warning you, you're about to lose your account unless you click here.
That's
and
a phishing
it says
attack.
It's from eBay.com. It says it. I mean, it says eBay.com is mailing this to you, and you're saying those are the kind. They've learned how to imitate and look like and morph into just about anything that you could trust.
Exactly. And ID theft and phishing attacks are a $50 billion a year problem, and they're growing. Phishing and ID theft are the two fastest growing crimes in the world because it's so easy to do. You know, you don't have to be a burglar. You have to have fairly good mechanical skills. You have to be within the area where you're going to do burglary. You know, stealing in East Harlem is different from stealing in Westchester. And you have to have different skill sets. But if you are semi-good with computers, or you download software off the Internet for free to do it, you could be a teenager in Eastern Europe. You could be a Nigerian unemployed state worker in Nigeria who sends out all those 419 scams. You know, you could be
409 scams.
Named after penal code, the Nigerian penal code. That's where you get the, hi, I'm the wife of late Sani Abacha. I've got $150 million.
And I don't know what to do with it, and please handle it for me until I get there.
And the way those scams work is you reply back to them. You say, sure, I'll help you for a cut of the profits. They ask you for your bank account, a processing fee. You lose your bank account. You lose your information. You lose your money. They're never seen from again. And now there's a large growing presence of organized crime out of Eastern Europe that is using computers to commit serious fraud, to steal billions of dollars a year. And everyone is at risk. You know, it used to be in the old days, 3-4 years ago, that computer crime involved large corporations, banks, Fortune 500 companies, and so on. And people were stealing thousands or millions of dollars at a time if they could. Today, with the prevalence of email, where it costs you almost nothing to send, and you can send billions of messages a day, you know, billions of messages a month, rather. You know, if all you get is one person out of a billion who falls for your scam, it's profitable. So the new twist on ID theft and cybercrime has been to do micro theft. Instead of stealing a couple hundred bucks out of your account, I'll charge $1.97 out of your account. I'll charge $1.17 out of Stephanie's account. I'll steal $2 from John's account. Stuff you'll never notice. But if I steal it from several thousand people at a time, that's a couple of $1 million a year in tax-free income anywhere in the world. And that's what makes ID theft such an attractive crime. Because it's easy to do. It's very low cost to get into. You need almost no skills to do it. Because people fundamentally have this relationship with their computers where they believe everything they read. You know, the email you sent.
Let me just ask you a question.
Go for it.
So if somebody, Raj, if you get $1.97 out of my account, and let's say you take it out of my bank account or my credit card, where are you usually taking it?
Both. Yeah, if I compromise your credit card, I'll charge your credit card. If I compromise debit card instead, I'm taking straight out of your account.
Okay, so now let's say I look at the only safety here is now I have to start looking at my statements. In the past, people, a large number of people who felt like they didn't want to spend their lives trying to make their bank account work just said, well, I trust the bank.
Correct.
Now, if you don't look at your bank statements without knowing it, you could very easily be losing small amounts of money at first, right? And then it could become bigger and bigger. But, you know, who would ever check on a $5 bill?
Most people wouldn't. And that's why this crime is so interesting to look at. But what happens is, your information doesn't stay with the guy who stole it. It gets sold. It gets traded over the Internet for more accounts, passwords, whatever have you. And next thing you know, like this lady we talked about earlier, she went from no theft to within a couple of days losing $3,000, emptying out her bank account.
And if she hadn't caught that, I mean, if it doesn't get caught, you mean it just continues on?
It continues on until you catch it, and the law can both be on your favor and against you, depending on how you behave around it. You know, if you suspect there's something going on, and if you notify your bank or your card company within 2 days, you have $50 liability. For most banks, you have almost zero liability. If you wait, within 2 months, if you notify your bank, your financial institution, I think there's something funny going on, and you work with them, your liability is capped at $500. If you wait more than 2 months, if you never review your statements, never contact them, then you could be liable for almost all the damages. So it's very important to review your statements. And, you know, it's not – look at where you know where you shop. You know, most people have habits. They eat the same restaurants. They shop at the same stores. They go to the same online sites. So if all of a sudden you see a $1.97 charge for Manny's House of Goodies and you've never been to Manny's, that's a good – you know, flag it. And see why it's there. You know, most reputable vendors use their name in their charge accounts, and most people shop within predictable patterns.
Is there a way of shopping on the Internet, Raj, where if you're using your credit card, you could be pretty much sure that you're really dealing with the person who says they're on the other side of it?
Well, there is no absolute security, but first, you know, use known reputable sites, eBay, Yahoo, GM, things like that. Going to smaller sites, smaller operators can be questionable. But one thing you can look for is when you connect to a site, and especially in the payment pages, look at the bottom right hand of your screen at your browser. You should see a little lock symbol. And if you see that, click on it, a little window will pop up. It'll give you details about the security site is using. You know, confirm that if you're going to Manny's
house. Wait, we're going to have to slow that down. You know exactly what you're talking about. Every time you order something on a computer, there's a little lock on the bottom right-hand side. John, is that on all computers?
It's defined by the site itself. And also you can tell from the address, it'll say https://, which is a secure site.
When you surf the web, your browser has a small key at the bottom. Every page you go to has a key on it. Good sites that use good security will use a secure site, which you can access through https://, and the site name.
I'm still not understanding. Okay.
All you need to remember, Armand, is when you next time you go on the Internet, open up your browser, look at the bottom right. There's usually a little key there. If you go to a safe e-commerce site, that key should turn into a padlock. When you click on the padlock, it'll give you information about what the computer thinks the site you're on at. So if you're going to Manny's House of Pizza to order a pizza, and you click on the lock and the window shows it's Manny's House of Pizza, you can be reasonably assured that you're talking to the right provider.
Oh.
But if it says, you know, Joe's Ball of Wax, and you went to Manny's House of Pizza, chances are you're not dealing with a reputable provider.
So when I got that inquiry from eBay, and they wrote to me and they said you've got to quickly send us your mother's name and your social security number and where your bank is, whatever they were sending me, right? Something that felt like that. If I had clicked on that button, I would have found out this really isn't from eBay.
Actually, that's a separate question. That's actually coming through email, not through a website. And first off, you know, a couple of things people should know. Never, ever give out your social security number to anyone. Whether it's over email or somebody calls you on the phone and says, I want to confirm some details, and can you confirm your social security number or your credit card number? The answer is no, thank you.
No to the social security number?
No. Most reputable providers, I would say almost all of them, will never ask you for your account number, your password, or your social security numbers.
Well, eBay will.
eBay does not send out.
If it's signing you up for the first time, doesn't it ask you for your social security number?
It does not ask social security number. It asks you for your name, address, phone, and occasionally how do you want to pay, a credit card or check. They do not ask social security numbers. In fact, by law, private institutions should not be using social security numbers in the first place. Social security numbers were only designed for the federal government. People use them in contravention of a law which almost everybody ignores, but they're not supposed to.
There's a new law that was passed yesterday, wasn't there?
Yes. It's
that you're all excited about. I can see you dancing.
Oh, I love this. This is, and let me get the exact name for it. It's right here. It's the New York State Information Security Breach and Notification Act. That's a mouthful. What it basically is a mandatory disclosure law like the one California passed 2 years ago. And this is a phenomenal, phenomenal tool for consumers. Because now if a business gets broken into anywhere in the country and they have information about New York State residents in their computers that may have been breached, these companies are now obligated to notify the consumers, hey, we've had a security break-in, we've had a hacker attempt, we've had a virus outbreak, something, and your information may have been compromised. It's thanks to this California law that we found out about LexisNexis, Card Systems, Paymax, all the big security breaches we've seen in the news. They came out because they had information on California residents, and under California state law, they were obligated to notify California residents in writing.
Are there really simple preferences that people could elect when using email that would make things a little safer than other things? Like, for example, what are your search engines that are safer than what search engines?
Search engines generally don't have security or email issues because they don't ask you for stuff. You're looking for information on them.
But you were saying something about Mozilla as opposed to...
Oh, absolutely. We're talking about browsers and email. You know, most people use Windows, and that's Windows as a fact of life. Most people also use what comes out of the box because it's always been there. But if you use Firefox or Mozilla on the Windows as opposed to using Internet Explorer, and if you use things like Thunderbird, which is a free email client versus Outlook, and you use good antivirus and anti-spyware software on your PC, you can reduce your chances of infection by almost 90%.
So you think Outlook has got more danger?
Outlook and Internet Explorer have more security issues. They have more bugs. But the biggest problem with them is since everybody uses them, almost all the attacks target the Windows platform, and they target Internet Explorer and Outlook bugs because 99% of all computers use Windows. So if you use Firefox or Mozilla for a web browser, which are both free, or use Thunderbird for email client, or use Pegasus Mail or something else, if you are unique, they'll go after somebody else.
How about using BrainLink?
Oh, absolutely. Come on down. We will help you practice safe computing, practice on the Internet.
And I think we also have to look at, you know, a lot of people look at the Macintosh the same way as a platform that is not as vulnerable at this point. I don't know. The vulnerability is there. The attacks aren't there.
But it's significantly lower. I would agree.
But I was just going to bring up the fact that Apple has just come out with their latest round of security updates, and there's probably 8 or 10 of them in this last week, which is indicating that the vulnerability is there, but because so many people or so few people use a Mac, it's like graffiti. It's no fun to attack us. They can't have the impact on the computer world on the Mac. But that doesn't mean we're safe.
I would fully agree. You know, there's never 100% safety or security.
Right.
But it's the old thing about, you know, if you're in the woods and the bear's chasing you, you don't have to outrun the bear. You have to outrun your friend. So in the computer world, if everybody's using Windows and they're using Internet Explorer and Outlook, you don't have to be secure. You just have to be more secure than them.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's kind of an interesting thing because one of the things we found is that there was a little period of time, there was a short period of time, when people could really slide with their computer. There was a time when you were safe and comfortable. The time is over. It's a pity because there was maybe a 5-year period where everybody learned how to use a computer and anybody could do anything they want. Is it true that every email is saved somewhere, or is that not true?
Probably true.
Probably true that there's somewhere every email that ever went through two people?
I would say with 99.9%, but not 100%, but 99.9% accuracy, I would say, with confidence, it's been saved in at least two places.
It's been saved in at least two places.
Absolutely.
How secure is something like Hotmail and those free ones that do?
They aren't. Email by itself is not secure, and using free sites is even more insecure because you're getting something for free. They have to make money. You are subject to their privacy policies. You're getting a free service, and they can do whatever they want with your email, and they say so in their privacy terms. You know, Hotmail has had its own security issues. Gmail, which is very popular because they give you so much free space out of the box, they tell you up front, and they're honest about it, they will never, ever delete an email. They will almost guarantee that your email will never be deleted if you use Gmail, which is a massive security problem because now you're giving out your personal information. You know, you take orders on the Internet, you send personal emails on the Internet, you send love letters, you send invoices, you send faxes. Everything about your life is now being stored on somebody else's computer, someone with whom you have no relationship, you do not have a contractual obligation with them. They can do whatever they want, and they tell you up front about it, and it's up to you, really, you know, to weigh the consequences. Do you want something for free where you have no privacy and no rights, or do you want to go towards other providers whom you do have a contractual relationship and you can say, I want my information deleted?
Well, you see, now there it is right there, my friends. Armand DeMille here with you with The Positive Mind. We have relationships with people and we have relationships with computers. Now, what if you don't have a relationship to anybody in the world? Here's a way to start relationships. Put your credit card and keep no balance in your account, and then put it up there and let everybody start spamming you and scamming you. Because the way you're saying it, Raj, and the way you're saying it, John, you can have new relationships with people in Middle Europe. They can just come to you and they'll start saying hello. You'll be getting letters from all over the world. If you are isolated and alone and you'd like to meet a new group of people, these people are just sitting there dying to meet you.
And there's several hundred dead Nigerian dictators who are dead and allowed to meet you today.
That's
right. There's a whole bunch. But here's the advantage of it. If you have nothing to lose, you're really in the best position possible, you know? I ain't got no lock on my door. That's no way to be, right?
They can steal
the rug from the floor.
Well, it's funny. I've gone through my own personal attempts to limit my visibility. So I have fewer credit cards now. I have smaller balances on them. We only use one card in our family for the Internet. It has a very small max limit on it. So that in that way, we're trying to limit the way in which we can get hit, because nothing is perfect. I forgive me for reading over Raj's shoulder, but I'm looking at some of the stuff about identity theft. And the first things that I'm seeing actually don't have as much to do with the computer as much as they do with your personal sanitary. You know, do your stuff. Make sure you shred your bills before you put them in the trash.
ID theft is not purely a cyber crime. Yeah. It's more prevalent in the Internet world, but ID theft is a real-world crime. You know, people stealing your information from your mailboxes. They will steal your credit card applications. They will steal your mail. You throw stuff in the garbage. If you're not shredding your paperwork, you might as well just put it up on a billboard, because by law, you don't own your trash. You put something in the garbage, put it on the curb, I can go in there, grab whatever I want. You can't do anything about it. And that's how people steal your information.
Well, you know, so this is what we're going to have to watch for. You can learn a lot more about this by going to the BrainLink website, and Raj has published a number of articles that are available on there. He teaches all over the world classes on Internet safety and learning about it and learning about even medical security, you know, for different people. And we also have with us John Greenleaf from Mac Mechanics. If people wanted to reach you, Raj, I guess the way is through BrainLink, right?
Email raj@brainlink.com.
Raj@brainlink.com. That's easy. And, John, how do they get you?
Well, John, my cell phone number is 917. No, our office number is 212.
Is it? What's an email address?
The email address would be theleaf, theleaf, at angel.net.
theleaf@angel.net. How cute. People always ask me what BrainLink is, and I love telling them. Hey, I will be back with you tomorrow, my friends, at... No, not tomorrow. This is Armand DeMille. It's been very exciting. If you want a copy of today's program, you can call 212-757-4488. If you look at the website, thepositivemind.com, look at our archives, or send me an email, armand@whereelse.com. BrainLink.com. Bye-bye for now.
Tuned to listener-supported, commercial-free community radio WBAI in New York at 99.5 FM. Thank you very much, Armand DeMille. and the Positive Mind. Coming up next at 2 p.m. will be Perspective with Luis Reyes Rivera, but first this.
Hi there. This is Vajra Kilgour, chair of the WBAI Local Station Board, inviting you to the next regular meeting on Wednesday, August 24th at 6:30 p.m. in the second floor art gallery of the Adam Clayton Powell Jr. State Office Building, located at 163 West 125th Street at 7th Avenue in Harlem. Take the 2, 3, A, B, C, or D train to 125th Street. The location is wheelchair accessible and public comment is welcome.
Okay, mark your calendars. WBAI is going to have a party on the pier. It's all going to take place on Sunday, August 28th from 3 p.m. to 10 p.m. at Pier 63 on West 23rd Street and the Hudson River.
Please remember that this program is supported by the listener members of WBAI New York. If you like what you hear, please consider becoming a member of WBAI or renewing if you've already joined. Basic membership is $25, but we accept any amount. Help us keep free speech alive.